The John Williams Show. I'm Matt Bubala filling in for John today here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. We've got Eric Rung in the newsroom and Joe Brand in the sports department. We'll be with you until noon when we have the business lunch. Morning, boys. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent.
Yeah,
doing well.
Very good. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing good. It's good to be here in some daylight hours. I normally host overnights, Friday into Saturday morning from 1 to 5 a.m. Much different look out these windows at that time. Walking here today, it's beautiful outside. It's a beautiful day to be downtown Chicago. If you've got shopping to do, as I imagine most of you still do, it's windy, but it's sunny. And so it's, you know, it looks like we're not going to have a white Christmas, but we'll have nice shopping days leading up to it, I guess, is the silver lining in that. Joe, I've got to ask you, guys are talking a lot about Yonder Alonso. We're going to have actually Phil Rogers, MLB writer, on later in the show. He's going to come on at 10:30 to talk about Machado and Harper and all these things. But Yonder Alonso, the White Sox trade for Yonder Alonso, first baseman from the Indians, who is Manny Machado's brother-in-law.
Correct.
Is that his sister's husband, or he's married to somebody who is...
His sister's husband. Manny Machado's married to Yonder Alonso's sister.
Sister's husband. Mm-hmm. Now... that could just be the White Sox wanted, but it doesn't, I mean, does it make sense other than this is a lure for Manny Machado? Because they had Abreu playing first base, right?
Correct. Yeah, a lot of people don't see the method for the move if they don't get Machado, because then you've got somewhat of a logjam with Abreu and Daniel Polka and Yonder Alonso all pretty much playing the same position. Also, Alonso bats lefty, Daniel Polka bats lefty. So a lot of people are curious if there's going to be a corresponding move after this, whether or not they get Machado.
All right, so let's go with the assumption that this is a puzzle piece to get Manny Machado to want to come here.
Mm-hmm.
How much research do you think goes into making sure, because let's face it, I don't know if you or Eric are married yet. I'm assuming now you guys are younger fellas.
I'm not married, no.
Okay.
On my way.
Okay. Joe, are you you have a fiancé?
I do.
Okay. Does she have brothers?
She does not have brothers, no.
Do you have brothers or sisters?
I only have two sisters.
You have two? Ooh, so okay. So now future Mrs. Joe Brand should be on the line for this. But she would tell everybody, guaranteed she's telling people how much she loves your sisters. Oh, they're great. I can't wait to be part of the family, yada, yada. I don't know that that's what she really thinks deep down. Now, I'm not trying to start any family problems, Joe. But what I'm saying is...
Yeah, hold your ears, Sam and Annie.
On the surface, we would always say how much we... adore and enjoy our time around our in-laws, but they're in-laws. And while there's Instagram photos of these guys together and stuff like that, I hope the White Sox really dug down deep to make sure that he wouldn't be like, you know, I like the guy, but that means, you know, all the time we got to be together, we got to go out to dinner, we got to this.
Well, it'd be one thing if they signed Manny Machado's mother-in-law or something like that. But
listen, the mother-in-law comes with the marriage, so there's no way out of that.
That's true.
She's already part of the package. But the brother-in-law and the extended family mean maybe he likes a little buffer zone, you know? Maybe he was thinking, yeah, we, you know, Cleveland and Baltimore were too close together. I don't know if I want Cleveland and Chicago, and now it's Chicago and Chicago.
Right.
Maybe he's
right.
Like, you know, Arizona's sounding really good.
Well, as far as I know, they are decent friends, at the very least. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find the Instagram post right now, and I can't.
Because Machado just deleted all records.
Yeah, right. There's a couple pictures of them both coaching some kind of youth league team. The last All-Star game Machado was at, Alonso went, and there's a picture of them two on the field. So as far as I know, it's a pretty good relationship. And again, it's really hard to find the reasoning here of why they would go after Yonder Alonso other than to try and up their pitch with Machado.
Who did the Bulls always have on their team when they had Rodman to like be the caretaker of Dennis Rodman? There was a player on the Bulls during the Rodman years, I swear, I'm not getting this wrong, who pretty much his role, he was like the 12th man, and I think his role was to make sure Dennis always made it back to the hotel, to make sure Dennis made it to the games.
I don't know. The name's escaping me because...
Because you were two when the Bulls won those championships. I
thought Phil Jackson really played a role in that when he was basically said, you know, we're going to let Rodman be Rodman.
Well, I think that's what you say. But then Rodman being Rodman, if that means he's spending 12 days in jail not playing the games, that's not, you know, that's not good.
True, but I definitely remember hearing stories about him still rolling into the hotel.
I'm sure he
late,
did.
Late or I'm early sure morning, I should say.
I believe the reason he made it back to the hotel, though, was because...
Wasn't there a...
Were you thinking of Jack Haley?
Jack Haley, I believe, might be the name.
I'm looking at a headline from 1996 in the Tribune that says, "No more babysitting for Haley." Haley spent last season living down his reputation as Dennis Rodman's babysitter. Now he's the number two center with the Milwaukee Bucks.
Oh, see?
Yeah, that's it. Well, isn't there a story of, and Eric brought it up with Phil Jackson, didn't Phil Jackson go to pick up, or at least wake up Dennis Rodman for practice once, and he was totally undressed in his apartment, and he's like, "This is how I live."
I remember hearing several stories like that, but Phil basically said, "Hey, as long as you show up and you rebound and play defense, then I don't care what you do.
Don't care about the color of your hair, don't care if you're wearing wedding dresses on covers of magazines, whatever it is, just show up and play ball." And you know what? Winning cures a lot of things.
That's true.
You put up with a lot when it's a good player who's getting the job done on the court. And, you know, they put up with him kicking the cameraman and all the... I mean, there was a lot of baggage that came along with Dennis Rodman. Overall, he comported himself pretty well when he was playing for the Bulls, and they won three more championships. So he got through it. But this sort of... I don't know what... You know, and Manny Machado doesn't come without his baggage as well.
That's true.
He's a heck of a player. But... you know, he not running out that ball in the playoffs with the Dodgers really seemed to carry. And I mean, he's had other issues over the years, right?
A couple of spike clips in the playoffs,
right,
too.
Yeah, he stepped on the back of the Milwaukee Brewers first baseman's leg.
Moustakas.
Yeah, he's not Chris Bryant. He's not walking around with some halo over his head, right?
Not right now, that's for sure. But you know, you've seen it a lot happen in baseball. I mean, heck, right in this city with David Ross to kind of lure John Lester here. And Chris Jimenez was signed before the Cubs acquired Yu Darvish because they were just personal catchers. Now, granted, those are battery mates. There's a little bit more involved there. But again, you got to respect this approach the White Sox are taking right now.
There have been more articles, as I mentioned, Phil Rogers will join us at 10:30. But there have been more and more articles this week that I've seen that are suddenly mentioning the possibility of the Sox actually signing both Machado and Harper. Do you really think that they are trying to? Would Jerry Reinsdorf open the pocketbook that big all at once?
Yes, I do. I was just in the winter meetings this past week, and everything that Rick Hahn and Rick Renteria said was just oozing optimism and taking advantage of the unique situation that this offseason holds right now. They've talked about how most of the times year three of a rebuild might be too early, but they can't just not take advantage of the two.
Yeah, they won't be available when the team's ready.
Correct. So. And the other thing is, Matt, it makes so much sense. They have the money. There's going to be nobody on the books next year, practically. And they have the spots on the roster. So why not? And the whole Jerry Reinsdorf argument, you know, a lot of people thought he wouldn't be for a rebuild. Well, he was. A lot of people thought he wouldn't be willing to trade with the Cubs to make them better. Well, he did. So why wouldn't he be able to open the books right now?
Well, I think the only business-wise, I guess, would be the question, because the Sox are not like the Cubs where they're in a festival atmosphere up there. No matter, you know, the Cubs are able to go through a rebuild and still draw a couple million people. When the Sox go through a rebuild, Sox fans are much more finicky. If you're not putting the product on the field, they're not showing up in the stands, and that's how it's worked. So I guess spending all that money, you question, well, if you're only getting $10,000-$15,000, is Jerry going to put up with that for too long? But I guess on the other side, you argue, if we put Machado and Harper in, even if we're not playing that well, the commitment the ownership is showing to the fans, hopefully, in the marketing you'd be able to do around those two guys, would bring the people out. I guess that would be the thinking.
I think so, too. And I think Jerry is just, I mean, heck, he's what, 82 years old?
Yeah, or 83, I think.
I think he wants to pull the trigger now, and he wants to bring another championship.
And he's probably sick of people talking about the Cubs so much.
That, too.
I mean, I imagine that helps. You imagine the thunder they would steal from the Cubs if they could sign those two guys.
I know.
And meanwhile, the Cubs making more money than God, saying we don't have enough money to go after one of these guys. I don't know that I believe. Do you believe the Cubs are really lying this low, or are they stealthily waiting to swoop in here?
I don't think they're... the thing is, they need to be incredibly creative in order to make this happen. They're handcuffed with money, and they're handcuffed with spots in the outfield, too, at least for the Bryce Harper argument. So you've got to move a Jason Hayward contract, and in order to do that, you've got to find someone who's going to be willing to take that, which is going to be incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And you're probably going to have to package deal somebody else, like a Kyle Schwarber or Elmora or whoever.
Or a prospect at the very least.
And they don't have many of those anymore.
Yeah. And probably eat some of the contract, too, right?
Exactly. And that doesn't end up really helping you that much.
Jay have, like, 5 years left at, like, $20 million a year or something like that?
Five years, yeah. The original deal was, what, 7 years, $187 million?
So you would have used up 3 years of that then, right?
Correct. Yeah. Something along those lines. I don't know the complete semantics, but, yeah, it's a lot for a while.
Yeah, no kidding. So it'll be interesting. 312-981-7200 is our number. We'll talk more about sports after 10:30 with Phil Rogers. At 11 o'clock, Mike Tackett from the New York Times D.C. Bureau. You remember him as a longtime reporter and editor for the Chicago Tribune before he moved on to D.C. and the New York Times. He'll give us the week that was and the week that's coming in D.C. Of course, as always, lots going on there. It never seems to stop. And we'll take your calls as well. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala in for John Williams here on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala in for John Williams. John and the crew are winging their way back from Mexico. They had socks on the beach all week, courtesy of Apple Vacations. So they're coming back. So John will be back with you next week, all week long, I believe, on the show. In fact, Monday, Griffin, can you jump on and give us the details? On Monday, John is hosting a very special event with Lee Steinberg, right?
Is that right? Yeah, of course.
Come on, Griff.
Yeah, he's doing that.
Yes, he is here at WGN Radio. I believe there's going to be, for people who bought tickets, I don't know if tickets are still available. Griffin, could you look that up? Here at WGN Radio, Lee Steinberg, longtime famous sports agent. In fact, this is the inspiration for Jerry Maguire, I believe, right? Lee Steinberg, he'll be with John. He's got a book out. They're going to do an off-air conversation, then a one-hour on-air conversation. I believe starting at 1 o'clock on John's regular show here on WGN. And then you'll have your John Williams all week long. He missed out on the It's a Wonderful Life spectacular yesterday. Bill Leff recreated It's a Wonderful Life as a radio play. Actually, it was a radio play after the movie came out. Jimmy Stewart was actually in it at least once, I know. But Bill Leff added his own special touches to it. We had a lot of fun with that yesterday here. And you can catch all of that, if you missed it, at WGNradio.com.
And WGNradio.com/events. That it's the first thing that pops up is the event with Lee Steinberg, and you can register to attend.
So that would be a really interesting conversation, especially in light of all this stuff that's going on right now in sports and with the idea of Manny Machado or Bryce Harper possibly signing with our White Sox. In your Chicago Tribune this morning, and in, of course, all news services nationwide, there's a big story about the about Obamacare. A federal judge in Texas rules the entire Obamacare health care law as unconstitutional. A federal judge in Texas threw a dagger into the Affordable Care Act on Friday night, ruling that the entire health care law is unconstitutional because of a recent change in federal tax law. They changed the ruling where you would get penalized if you didn't register for health care, that you would get a tax violation. The Republicans took that out. Because of that, U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor overturned the entire law, and this is on the eve of the deadline to sign up for coverage. I believe the last day to sign up is today, right?
That's correct.
And so people are like, now, if you're going to sign up for it, don't not because of this, because this is going to be appealed, of course, and then it might work its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. Who knows what's going to happen? And Nancy Pelosi, who's going to take over Speaker of the House, is, you know, saying, we'll fix this when we get in. She's not really going to have the power to do that necessarily because they don't control the Senate. But it's going to throw things into quite a bit of disarray, which really health care has been in quite a bit of disarray ever since the Affordable Health Care Act. Rates have gone through the roof on a lot of things. Now, it's provided a ton of protections for a lot of people, which is a wonderful thing that we need. But it certainly has been anything but perfect. And so we'll see what's going to happen in this. But if you were thinking, oh, I've got to sign up, it's the last day, and then you heard this news, don't not sign up because of that. Still sign up, still get yourself registered. You don't know that the law is truly going to change or not because of the appeals process and everything else that we'll go through. All right, Phil Rogers, writer for MLB.com and Forbes magazine. He's been writing a lot of pieces on sports for Forbes Online. We'll jump on with us right after the 10:30 news here on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Eric. We'll have another news update for you at 11 a.m. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala in for John Williams this morning. We're at the Allstate Skyline Studio high above the Chicago River on a beautiful day in Chicago. Joining us on the phone right now is Phil Rogers. He is a contributor to the MLB Network. He's writing pieces for Forbes. He's all over the place, especially with all the stuff going on in baseball right now with the winter meetings. Hey, Phil, how are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for jumping on the phone. We appreciate it. You've written a lot this week about Manny Machado and Bryce Harper, and something that I think 2 weeks ago we would have laughed at if anybody had said there's a possibility that both of them end up playing for the Chicago White Sox next year. Is that really a feasible possibility?
Well, I mean, it's to go 2 for 2 in those free agent pursuits. Still has to be unlikely, but I mean, it's clear that you know, it is what the organization thinks could happen. The organization thinks they could have both of those huge contracts on, you know, on the same roster. And you know, it is, you know, impressive in how they position themselves to kind of, be in that picture. But, you know, I would have told you 2 weeks ago that the White Sox were going to make the highest bid to at least one of those guys, and I'll still tell you that. I mean, I think that's the route to getting these guys is they have the payroll flexibility, they have the resources, and they have the motivation. Now, whether that lands them either of them, I don't know, but I think Jerry Reinsdorf is going to make not just an extremely competitive bid, but I think he's going to make the best bid on the table for one of those two guys, and that usually gets you the player.
Does it help in some ways that they're going after both? Would that help with either of the players? Because, you know, you look at the White Sox right now, they've had a couple of really tough seasons. They're still in rebuilding mode. Weren't really expected to be contenders this year. But if Harper said, wow, and Machado's going there, and Machado said, and Harper's going there, then they had two superstars, I would think, in some ways. Does that help them in the pursuit if there was the possibility of getting both?
Well, I think the aggressiveness definitely helps. I mean, if you, you know, these things don't happen in a vacuum. So if you went back to the end of October, the end of the World Series, and you looked at what the White Sox had done the last few years, and you tried to do that then, it would have been a reach. But not only, you know, the other moves they've made, the moves that we can already, you know, talk about, trading for Ivan Nova, trading for Alex Colome, last night trading for Yonder Alonso. I think those kind of moves show those guys that, look, we're looking not just to wait for these young guys to grow and get there, but we're going to try to make additions along the way. You're not coming to a wasteland, which, you know, let's be honest, the last couple of years, 2018, you know, it was fun watching some of the young White Sox players play. And Jose Abreu is a very solid pro, and it's always good to watch him hit. But to some degree, it's been a baseball wasteland, and that would have been a really tough sell. But I think Rick Hahn and Jerry Reinsdorf have changed the dynamic by making these other moves. And it's interesting. I personally think Bryce Harper wants the spotlight, and having Machado wouldn't really be a draw to him one way or another. But I think for Manny Machado, I think it might make it more attractive if there was another guy there to take a lot of the attention. I mean, you know, those two guys combined, I mean, they're both kind of show ponies, but I think Harper is kind of a one of the kind. You know, there aren't many celebrity ball players. You look at Mike Trout being the best player in baseball the last 5 years. He's not necessarily a celebrity. I mean, Harper is probably more celebrity than ball player, and, you know, I think he would thrive in the spotlight.
And what would this mean in Chicago, being here all these years? You know that the rivalry, not just between the Cubs and the Sox, but between the fans, and with the Cubs having led the way the last few years, what would this mean for the Sox? Do you think, I know Jerry Reinsdorf wants to get back in contention and at the age of 82 or 83, probably, you know, wants to do it sooner rather than later, but is the Cubs having all this success been a big motivator for them as well, do you think?
You know, I think they're used to it because, I mean, you go back the history of these two ownership groups, and I think it was probably more maddening for Jerry Reinsdorf when Tribune Company owned the Cubs. There were times when the White Sox had the better team. There were a lot of years, but the greater attention always seemed to fall on Wrigley Field, and it has to bother you, but look at the economics of it now. I mean, you know, the White Sox have been very low in attendance. I think last year they were 23, 24, 25, somewhere in there in major leagues in attendance, despite the size of the market. But even worse, you know, I'm told they've been number 29 or 30 in ratings. And now you have the Cubs leaving NBC Sports Chicago almost certainly. That station is owned 50% by Jerry Reinsdorf with between the Bulls and the White Sox. And, you know, they're going to need to carve out an audience there that it doesn't include the Cubs. So between the Blackhawks who are down, the Bulls who are down, and the White Sox, they've got to really sort of make a statement that they're going to have a strong brand, you know, for 2019 going forward when the Cubs get their new TV deal, whatever it is. And, you know, you could not make a stronger statement. And when I put all the names down on paper, the prospects that are in the system, and you start mixing in some of these other names, and you look at Eloy Jimenez, you know, who, if the White Sox weren't going for Harper Machado, we'd be talking a lot about Eloy Jimenez looking forward to 2019. He is a stud. He is going to be, you know, he could be the White Sox Chris Bryant. He is a big time player, and you know, you put him, you know, alongside Harper and or Machado, and you know, you factor in these other names, and similar to the Cubs, although in greater numbers, you know, they have these young guys that it's going to be 3 or 4 years until they take up a significant portion of the payroll. That creates the chance to go out and spend crazy money for the next few years, you know, and I think I think either a deal, Harper Machado, is going to include an opt-out clause, and that's not a bad thing for the team. I mean, if they were to say they did sign both Harper and Machado, I think it's very unlikely they would have them together more than 3 years, because I think there are going to be opt-out clauses after the third year for both of those guys. And they're young free agents. That's part of why they're so attractive as free agents, is how young they are to get to free agency. So 3 years down the road, you could see them wanting to take another crack at it if they produce 3 good years. I mean, look at Alex Rodriguez. The Texas Rangers signed Alex Rodriguez in a similar fashion for the 2001 season. He was there 3 years. They paid him crazy money.
Yeah.
He led the American League in home runs for 3 years, and then he wound up being traded. And he is ultimately with the Yankees. The opt-out there was after 7 years. And the time since then, those opt-outs have been pushed up forward. So I think the White Sox are creating this. They're accelerating the timeline on when they're going to be a really interesting team with their young players. But they, you know, they could put themselves, you know, 2 years from now, they could be the more interesting team in Chicago, believe it or not. I mean, Cubs fans, I don't see the Cubs ever regressing in a big way. But they're, you know, Anthony Rizzo's contract's up. Chris Bryant is going to be tough. You know, you're not going to be able to keep the band together. So you're going to have to go out and find new ways to bring in guys. That could be happening just as the White Sox are really taking off with their young guys. So I think this is really, really exciting. And to get one of those guys signed would be huge for the White Sox. And, you know, two is probably still a little pie in the sky, but it's, you know, it is an option that's in play, as Bob Nightingale, I think, was the first guy to really point out last night on Twitter.
Well, it's interesting you mention A-Rod, because that contract, that's also a bit of a cautionary tale, isn't it? Because didn't the Rangers kind of teeter on, like, they couldn't afford anything else once they added that contract? Didn't that contract kind of destroy that team in some ways, and that's why they had to get rid of him?
I don't know that it destroyed the Rangers, but they didn't win with him. I mean, they were in last place the 3 years that he was there, and they wound up wind up paying crazy money for him. But it kept them relevant. It kept them viable. You know, and you know, I think that has a price. And you know, the difference was they added him to an older roster, mm-hmm. and you know, I think you know that if you got to look at where they were when Alex went there, you know, I think the parallel that's interesting is if you go back, you know, nationally a month ago, I think people knew the White Sox were going to participate for Harper and Machado. I think they'd been kind of transparent about that, but I don't think any the White Sox a chance.
Yeah,
that's very similar to Alex Rodriguez and the Rangers. I covered that closely, and that came almost out of nowhere at the winter meetings in Dallas. I mean, the it was always about the Mets. It was about the Braves. It wasn't about Texas until pretty much a deal had come together. And, you know, he was a Scott Boras client, similar to Harper. He took the offer that was a lot more. I mean, the White Sox were participating in that and were frustrated that they couldn't get a meeting at the winter meetings with Alex Rodriguez because Boras did a great job of keeping him in the wings. So if he had not gotten a deal with the Rangers, the White Sox would have been meeting with him right after the winter meetings, but they got the deal, so it never happened. You know, to me, the Alex Rodriguez saga, if you play that out, kind of shows the blueprint for how the White Sox could wind up with one of these guys, which is essentially being the most motivated team, offering him the best deal.
Well, I imagine the other difference, if I'm remembering correctly, Phil, at that time when that, well, first of all, the Rangers offered him, you wrote about this, like double what everybody else was offering him, right? They blew it out of the water, and that was a time when payrolls, good payrolls, were more around $100-110 million altogether, and they were giving him a quarter of that versus an upper echelon payroll now, what the luxury tax kicks in at $206 million. So the team overall has a lot more money to spend in general than the Rangers probably had after giving all of that to just one player, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about how much can you pay one player and still compete. And like 15% was kind of the choking point, that nobody knew if you could give one player more than 15% of the payroll and still win. And the Rangers proved, you know, the Rangers would be an example that you can't do that. But, you know, the Rangers were way down the road. They had at one point really committed to young players, but that was almost a decade before this came along. And they had lost, I think it was 91 games the year before making this move. So, you know, you're right about the money. It was $252 million. And what was reported and has kind of been established as fact was the Braves were the second best offer, and it was $126 million, so exactly wow. Half as much. And Boras got kicks to bid against himself at least once or twice and up it when there wasn't anything else on the table. However, you know, I was told the White Sox were prepared to go to like $200 million. So if that was, wow. You know, if that was true, and that's something only the White Sox would know, and they do a great job of sitting on that information internal, you know, the 252 wasn't as crazy as it sounds.
Phil, I'll let you go here in a second, but what do you think it's going to take for Machado or Harper? Is this a 10-year $300 million, a 10-year $400 million? What does the contract look like in your mind that one of these guys does end up signing for?
Well, I think Harper's going to be significantly bigger than Machado, more than 10% bigger, so... you know, for Bryce, it's, you know, and I don't know if anybody gets to 400. It might be 350 for Harper and 300 for Machado, but they're going to be incredibly complicated agreements with between opt-out clauses and all of the different provisions in them. And, you know, I'm always surprised. Numbers are always bigger than you think. And don't lose sight of the fact Major League Baseball is in an incredible era of being awash with revenue. And, you know, for the White Sox who are sitting there, once you take the Abreu contract off the table, next year, I mean, I don't think they have $10 million in guaranteed money on their payroll, and they have this. They have all the pieces. You're not doing crazy projections to say Michael Kopech's going to come back from Tommy John surgery. Dylan Cease is going to get there, or Dane Dunning is going to be there. They have so many young arms that they're going to have tons of 0-3 players at least over the next 3 or 4 years. Luis Robert could be a significant guy, and they've already, it's a sunk cost in signing him. So his payroll, his salary is not going to be big. So they can really afford a lot. And, you know, they've never really gone over like $135 million in payroll, but that's sort of an artificial deadline. And if they participate, you know, if their TV deal really allows them to maximize their revenue the way other teams have, their payroll could go to levels that we haven't come close to seeing. So what I'm trying to say, a lot of words to say, the final number will probably be higher than you and I would write it out today, because that's just the way it works in free agency. At the end of the day, the numbers are bigger than you think they're going to be.
But theoretically, then, the White Sox go 35 for Harper, 30 for Machado, $65 million guaranteed. They could put together, with all the young talent they have coming up, with another $100 million, a competitive team. This is actually not crazy talk, but for $165 million over the next 4 years or 5 years, they could actually make this happen and not, you know, go light years over the tax threshold.
They could do it for less. They could do it for 100, and, you know, those guys could be making 70, and you could put together, with the young talent they have in their system, you could definitely put together a playoff caliber roster for another $70 million over that. And, you know, what makes that so possible is they don't have the other roster. They don't really have a lot of hard decisions to make with guys that are 1 year away from free agents or arbitration or just got into arbitration. So I think, you know, you can pick and choose from veterans to fill holes. You can certainly do that with bullpens every year. So I think you could have, two mega salaries on a very competitive team and probably keep the payroll, you know, around $140-150 million, which would be a record for the White Sox. But, you know, that would put you maybe in the middle of the pack, not even quite in the middle of the pack in Major League Baseball.
It would be a heck of a Christmas gift for all the White Sox fans out there, that's for sure. We'll see what happens over the next couple of weeks. Follow Phil Rogers on Twitter. He's a great Twitter follow, at Phil G. Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S. See him on the MLB Network, and a lot of pieces appearing in Forbes.com. Phil, thank you so much for jumping on the phone this morning.
Thanks very much for having me. It was fun.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon. You're Phil Rogers there. See him at MLB Network. Does a lot of great reports there. And, of course, on Twitter, at Phil G. Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S. News coming up next on 720 WGN. It's Matt Bubala filling in for John Williams here on 720 WGN. I am a lifelong diehard Cubs fan who just spent a half an hour talking to a national sports reporter about the White Sox without even talking about the Cubs. That is, to me, means something is really actually happening on the South Side.
Progress.
I mean, listen, hey, I'm always going to be a Cubs fan. We've got the White Sox, and nobody, I will say this, I'm sorry, Mr. Reinsdorf, if you're listening, but nobody here was less excited about us getting the White Sox than I was, because I grew up a Cubs fan. But, wow, my mother-in-law is a diehard Sox fan, my brother-in-law is a diehard Sox fan, and that would be incredible. And to hear Phil actually say that, possibly the White Sox committing around $800 million to two players would actually make business sense was what stunned me the most about that. Because I didn't think about the fact that, you know, the Cubs are probably going to opt out of this TV network. The White Sox need to, you know, keep that station going. Let's face it, the Bulls are in a downtime. The Hawks are in a downtime. If the Cubs leave that network, that's going to hurt NBC Sports Chicago. So this all actually seems to somehow make sense that the White Sox could land Manny Machado and Bryce Harper. God, that would be crazy. See what happens. Joe, when do you think any of this finally happens? When are meetings are over?
Boris
always holds out till the last possible minute so somebody else sets the market and then he can raise the bar, right?
Yeah, that's the unfortunate thing. I mean, we didn't see Jake Arrieta get signed until March last year, and that's Jake Arrieta. A lot of people are saying at the earliest, the week in between Christmas and New Year's, and a lot of other people are just thinking until after January. I mean, Scott Boras is going to do everything he can to make sure his client gets the most possible.
So he's going to let Machado get signed, and then he's going to say, okay, now if you want Harper, it's this much more, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
So White Sox, they traded for Yonder Alonso. Here's my prediction. They'll sign Manny Machado before Christmas, and then before New Year, Bryce Harper.
That's a bold prediction.
What's your odds on that actually happening?
Both, Joe? Before the New Year?
Well, just that they even get both. Do you think that's really possible? I mean, are we just talking crazy?
I mean, I feel like Phil Rogers summed it up best. It is still a tall, tall task. But everything that has happened over the past few weeks has implied that the White Sox have the best shot, and it's most reasonable for them to land both.
I mean, the fact that we're just saying it is actually possible is the craziest thing. I mean, this actually now is sounding like an actual possibility.
I agree.
I guess that's as far as we get. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Thank you, Eric. Matt Pubala here with you, filling in for John Williams today as the John Williams Show and the Sox players and all the fans wing their way back from Sox on the Beach in Mexico. John will be back with you on Monday. He's got a special event with Lee Steinberg in the first hour of the show. You can go to WGNradio.com/events and find out more about that. Jumping on the phone with us right now from the New York Times DC Bureau, it's our old friend Mike Tackett. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing good. God, you guys, has this been the craziest 2 years of your life?
Well, it's the Full Employment Act, we'll put it that way.
Yeah, I believe it. By the way, I haven't chatted with you in a while. I recently watched on Showtime The Fourth Estate, the four-episode kind of docuseries about the New York Times and the reporters, just following reporters around from pretty much Inauguration Day till about a year ago. And it was really, and you made little brief cameos. You weren't a star of it, but you were in it. And it was really cool to just see how you guys work and what you go through and the arguments you have and the scoops you're trying to get. And it was just a really neat insight into what goes on in the world of journalism, especially out there in D.C. and New York.
Well, I really hope that people who watch that, what I hope that they take away from it is a greater understanding of how we actually do what we do, which is... And it shows the real care that people take to try to get it right.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people, the reporters who were in the very heat of that, boy, they worked absolutely tirelessly. And I think they did a pretty good job of reflecting that in the documentary.
Well, you know, it is interesting because, you know, I know President Trump enjoys calling you guys fake news and just whenever he doesn't like coverage, you know, lambasting you guys for it. But you really do see that when you guys do get something wrong, you're really upset about it and it hurts and you guys are mad at yourselves. And, you know, that there's a lot of fallout from that, that you guys do take great pains to try not to paint pictures a certain way, but paint pictures with the facts as best as you can get them.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if you step back and look at it with some remove, all of the big stories have held up quite well.
Yeah, it was really it's really interesting to watch. So let's talk about the last week in D.C. here, because there's so many different things we could talk about.
How much time do we have?
Well, we only have about 20 minutes, but let's see what we can do in that amount of time. One of the bigger stories, I think, this week that was being followed is the whole chief of staff thing. Chris Christie backs out of the role. The reporting from early in the week was that, you know, there's a lot of it's tough to find the right candidate. And President Trump said, hey, that's fake news. I got 10 different people. I can't interview as many people as want the role. And so he's saying that's not true, but the reporting and the inside sources seem to say there's a lot of confusion in the White House and a lot of, you know, just the usual chaos. Is he having trouble? And he named Nick Mulvaney the interim chief of staff now, right? Is that what's going on?
Right. Nick Mulvaney is a, just for people who don't know that name, is a former congressman from South Carolina He was elected in 2010 as sort of a Tea Party style candidate. And when he was in the House, he was a real fiscal budget hawk. And he was one of the original members of the Freedom Caucus. So that's the more hardline conservative wing of the House Republicans. He was selected to be the director of Office of Management and Budget by President Trump. And then he was also asked to oversee the Consumer Financial Protection Agency that had been established as part of the financial crisis. So it was really unusual to have sort of two jobs in one. Finally, someone else is now doing the consumer job. But then the president announced yesterday, about 5:18, I think, is when Eastern time, when the tweet came out, which is an interesting way to convey to the country who your top staff person is going to be. Mulvaney has a lot of strengths. He knows Congress well. He has some relationships on Capitol Hill, which can be helpful. He's thought to be a very organized person. But the way that we're told that he sold this, sold himself to the president, was, I'll manage the staff, but I won't try to manage you.
Well, that sounds like a bit that's interesting, because that's probably not what most people would say President Trump truly needs. It's maybe what he wants, but I think people would say that's not what a president needs, right? They need somebody not to just manage the staff, but to manage what the president is spending his time on. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, the job of chief of staff traditionally is, you could think of it like a corporation. This would be not the chief executive officer, but the chief operating officer. So this is somebody who really oversees who gets to see the president, what gets in front of the president, what is the day like, how is the overall White House operation managed. It's a very complicated job, and it requires extraordinary skill. And it usually, in most contexts, it requires both people rowing in the same direction. John Kelly, who's a retired Marine general, who is the current chief of staff, initially was thought to be somebody who would come in and bring discipline to the White House operation, to limit access to the president, to those people who he thought he only truly needed to see to execute the agenda. And there was always some friction over that because, you know, the president certainly has his own way of operating.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Is this then the moment in West Wing when the chief of staff writes on the napkin, let Bartlett be Bartlett? Is that how he kind of sold Trump? Hey, you're going to get to be who you are and I'll manage the people underneath you?
Well, I mean, you know, as the president so often says, we'll see what happens. He did name him acting chief of staff. He didn't name him chief of staff. So he doesn't step down officially as the budget director. Presumably giving both of them an exit strategy if things don't work out. But once again, you know, we're told, oh, there are 10 people that want the job. Now it's down to 5 finalists. And then day by day, either the president would eliminate somebody or people would step up and say they'd taken their own name out of consideration. This all started, remember, last week when the president wanted to have a younger person named Nick Ayers, who's a political operative from Georgia who had been the chief of staff to Mike Pence.
Right.
Now, in a normal world, if you're an ambitious 36-year-old political person and the president of the United States asks you to be the chief of staff, that's the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, they couldn't work out an arrangement, and Mr. Ayers said no.
What was the sticking point of the arrangement, do you think?
Well, some of our reporting showed that it was about the time commitment. Ayers has young triplets, although I would point out he had those same children when he was chief of staff to the vice president, which right. is also a full-time job. But nonetheless, those are very difficult jobs, very demanding, and can really take a toll on family. So that's possible that that's what it was. But I think we've all heard the politicians say they want to spend more time with their family as a way to gracefully get out of a situation. So I think it was probably both the duration of the assignment and then perhaps some dimensions of the assignment.
Chris Christie said he was dropping out of contention, told the president he had family things going on, too. Is that Chris Christie finding out he's not going to get it and jumping out before President Trump tweets something, or what happened there?
That's a difficult one to square. I mean, I only can say what Christie said himself in his statement and have to sort of take him at his word on that. You know, he brings some obvious advantages to the situation, but he doesn't really have, you know, a strong working relationship with Capitol Hill, other than I'm sure he knows a lot of those people. And it could also be that, you know, once you got up close and saw what the job was really going to be like, maybe it wasn't as appealing as they thought.
Well, it seems like it's got to be the toughest job in Washington right now, right? I mean, it probably normally is for any president.
I think it is normally the toughest job in Washington. And, you know, you could ask Mayor Rahm Emanuel about it since he's a former chief of staff. You could ask James Baker, who was so prominent last week during the funeral of President Bush, who was his chief of staff. I mean, it's an extremely demanding job, and it's why that some people have made something of the fact that this is the president's third person in that position. In that case, you know, it does have a lot of turnover because it's so all-consuming.
So really, I probably buried the lead here in talking about the chief of staff, because I don't know if Michael Cohen wasn't a bigger story, certainly towards the beginning of the week, and his speaking out about, now I was blindly following somebody I shouldn't have followed. He made his darkness to light reference. And while, you know, everybody is upset with President Trump all the time, Michael Cohen seems to be trying to paint himself as a bit of a victim here. And I think people are having trouble squaring the reality of that. Where do we see Michael Cohen heading besides upstate for 3 years?
Well, I think he's going to be very, very important to the investigation. It's interesting to me how there's the two sort of investigations seem to view him quite differently. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation seemed to think that he gave them quite a bit of cooperation. Federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, who seemed to be squeezing him much harder, seemed to be of a view that he wasn't as cooperative as he could have been. But one thing is for certain is that he is talking and he knows a lot of things. I mean, the president initially said that Cohen did a favor for him related to a condominium board action for Trump World Tower many years ago, and he described it as low-level work. Well, after that low-level work, he hired him to work for him for $500,000 a year. And who knows what he got paid after that. So I'm not sure that low-level work would necessarily jibe with paying somebody $500,000 a year. Clearly, Cohen knew a lot about what the president did. Clearly, he was someone the president turned to in the private sector to make problems go away. It's really not in dispute, even by the president, that these payments were made to Karen McDougal and Stormy McDaniels to stay silent about relationships with Mr. Trump. The thing that you don't know, the president now, as opposed to saying that it didn't happen, keeps emphasizing it's not criminal. So that gives actually some credibility to Michael Cohen, because he's the one who laid this out.
So moving on from him is Michael Flynn. And Mueller's office recommending actual zero jail time for Michael Flynn. And the crazy ironic thing to me in all of that is this all really starts in some ways with President Trump asking Comey to drop the whole Flynn thing. Hey, he's a good guy. Could you just drop this? So in a weird way, in the end, the president sort of gets what he wants. It looks like Michael Flynn maybe will serve no jail time, but everything else is coming in the meantime.
Well, that may be the outcome he was seeking back then. I'm not so sure that that would be good news for him today, because Michael Flynn, if he gets no jail time, that strongly suggests he gave a lot of cooperation and provided important information to the special counsel that So the leverage that they had over him of potential jail time, you know, they were willing to trade that for the information he was willing to give.
Yeah, definitely not the way that President Trump wanted to go about getting Michael Flynn to go ahead and walk free, but the outcome might end up the same. And the last thing, Mike, George Papadopoulos now says he's running for Congress in 2020. Is that the weird headline of the day?
Is this in the Grand Illinois tradition of interesting people who run for Congress or serve an elective office?
If he's going to run, he's picking the right state to do it, and if he's still going to be resident of Illinois. But that seems pretty crazy to come off of what he just did and say, and now I'm running for Congress.
Well, I certainly agree with that. That's sort of in league with the idea of Michael Avenatti running for president. You know, Will, I guess crazier things have happened, but he would have to go on quite a redemption tour before I think he would have a credible shot.
Yeah, no kidding. Michael Tackett from the New York Times D.C. Bureau. Always great to talk to you, Mike. Thanks so much for jumping. Oh, wait, I promised I'd ask you this. We just talked to Phil Rogers for half an hour about Machado and Harper. You love your Washington Nationals. They're not even being talked about. Are they not even trying to bring Bryce Harper back? Is that just out the window now?
Well, actually, what happened was the owners a couple months ago offered him $300 million for 10 years. And so that was seen as quite a credible offer. Sure. And not surprisingly, Harper wanted to test the market. And, you know, he'd look pretty good in right field at Wrigley.
He would, but nobody's talking about that. All they're talking about is the possibility of the White Sox signing him. They're the leaders in the clubhouse at the moment.
Yeah, the White Sox and the Phillies, and, you know, boy, what a terrible problem for him to have, you know, only taking $300 million or taking more.
Mike Tackett from the New York Times D.C. Bureau, thanks so much for jumping on, Mike.
Hey, Matt, great to speak to you again.
All right, you too. We'll talk again soon. Get your New York Times online at nytimes.com. We've got a break of the news coming up here on 720 WGN. Hey, Joe Brand, are you over there right now?
I am. What's up?
I'm just realizing that we talked about the White Sox for half an hour. Not only did we not talk about the Cubs, we haven't even talked about the Bears.
I know.
Today, and this is the biggest weekend, maybe, in some ways, the Bears have had in a long time. Not only can they beat the Packers for the first time since, I think my young son Michael told me, Thanksgiving of 2015, but also they could knock the Packers officially out of the playoffs and clinch the NFC North, all at Soldier Field.
Quite the redemption from opening day, right?
I was at that game.
Were you really?
I was at that game in Lambeau. My older son, Jack, wanted to go to Lambeau, so for his birthday, we got tickets. We went to that game, and that was the greatest first half I'd experienced in my life. Unfortunately, we stayed in the second half.
Hey, was that your first time at Lambeau?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you what. That's a great place
That's
to go see a game, and they were very nice and
That's
accommodating.
That's what I hear, too.
They were wonderful. The fact that we're walking around in Bears jerseys, they were cool. We had two real jerk Bears fans, of course, three rows in front of us, getting hammered, being jerks every time the Bears did something good. Finally, they got thrown out, thank God.
I probably know them, too.
Very, very poorly represented our fine city, but Lambeau's a great place to see a game, and it was a great game until the very end, until Rodgers did what he does. Now, we're all very excited about the idea of this, but you don't think there's any chance for Rodgers to do what he does and, like, really screw the Bears this way?
Because you look at what happened that first game and, you know, what much has changed, and the Packers just have a whole bunch of difficulties on their offense, no?
Yeah.
So the Bears' defense has really flourished the last few weeks, I mean, especially against L.A., and if you can shut down an offense that's been firing on all cylinders the past 2 years like that, you feel like there's really no openings for Green Bay to pull off the type of performance they had in the second half like that first game. I don't know. I mean, all signs point to the Bears. They really do. It'd be tough to argue anything else against it. You just hope that Mitch Trubisky is still healthy, and I know he didn't have his best game.
Shakes the rust off,
right, I know he didn't have his best game Sunday night, but you know, I think it will still be a test. I mean, the Bears and Packers always play tough, or at least the Packers do, and they don't want to go down quietly. So,
And we'll have our Bears, Three Bears post game coverage tomorrow, after the game, 3 o'clock on here. Hamp and OB. I'll tell you what, they give it to them when they don't play well, and they praise them when they play well. So it'll be interesting to see which OB has to show up tomorrow.
they give it to them a little bit when they play well.
That's true,
too.
That's true.
They expect nothing but the best. 100%.
They're complete Dick is super fans sometimes on that. show, right? 85-0
Yeah, it sounds like the Saturday Night Live skit every once in a while, but it's a whole bunch of great content, too.
Yeah, the only thing is, you know, and I worry about OB sometimes. When the Bears play bad, I seriously think, I hope that there's staff nearby. Do they know where the AED paddles are? Because OB loses it. It's fun to listen to. That's Bears postgame with Hamp and OB right after the Bears game this Sunday here on WGN Radio. News is next. Thank you very much, Eric. As you said, 11:38 in the morning, we've got Amy Guth with the Wintrust Business Lunch here at noon. Eric, I think there's, what are we, about 7 days away from, 9 days away from Christmas. Is there any chance in that forecast that there's snow coming up?
No.
Man. Which is fine. It's fine. It's fine.
I'm more than okay with that. I've had enough snow in my life. I don't need another white Christmas.
What are you, 25? You're done with snow for the rest of your life?
I wish I was 25. That would be nice. I you know, it was nice when I was a kid. I get it. But I'm fine with it now. Maybe that's I'm being selfish, actually. I'm sorry. My apologies to everybody out there that would like a little snow. I feel bad.
There's a lot of people that feel the way you do because snow causes all sorts of, you know, anxiety with the shoveling and the driving.
More because I have to work outside in it. That's why I don't enjoy the snow.
Oh.
Again, I'm being selfish. I get that. I understand.
No, Hey, everybody's got their own thing. That's okay.
It should snow 2 days a year, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and then that's it.
And then that's it. Huh?
Yep. Joe, I'm on board with that.
Yep.
I'd be okay with that for this year. I mean, we already had, out where I live out in West Dundee, we already had 9 inches earlier that, you know, right after Thanksgiving snowfall. So I'm okay with all this, but it is nice to have that little blanket for Christmas morning.
I remember one Christmas, I think it ended up being like 60 degrees almost.
When I was a kid, there was one, our neighbors had their convertible out.
That's awesome. I remember taking out the garbage in my shorts, and I'm like, this is a fantastic feeling.
Except for your neighbors.
That's true.
Who had to win it.
Gym shorts.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for clarifying. 312-981-7200 is the number. I'm Matt Bubala, filling in for John Williams. He'll be back on Monday with his special guest Lee Steinberg for a very special first hour of the show. And there's a luncheon you could attend, too. If you go on to WGNRadio.com/events, you can find out how you can get tickets to come and meet the man who is the inspiration for the movie Jerry Maguire. I'm reading a very interesting story in New York Times right now. I was scrolling through this morning before we had Mike Tackett on. And they have a story. Do you guys remember, Griffin, do you remember Octomom?
I just saw this story, too. Yes, I remember her, yeah.
That was from how many? Well, I guess the kids are 9 now, so that had to be almost a decade ago. She was hugely famous because she was going to have these kids. And I don't even remember now what all the scandal was about. Just that she was going through with it or she was trying to raise money for it?
Well, I was...
I don't want to hear how young you were, though.
I was going to say I was so young, and then I'm thinking back like, I wasn't that young. I should probably remember more about it, but...
If I remember right, it wasn't even so much her, it was the fertility doctor that the scandal was kind of around because I don't remember all the details, but I want to say it was the doctor that there was some scandal around.
Here we go, origin story. In 2008, Natalie Suleiman was implanted with 12 embryos by Dr. Michael Kamrava, a Beverly Hills fertility specialist who had also implanted her for all 6 of her previous in vitro pregnancies. It was hard to believe the octuplets all came from the same father, an unidentified sperm donor, and even harder to process that Ms. Suleiman didn't know she was having so many babies at once, but that's what she says. It took 46 scrambling doctors and nurses to perform the C-section. When Ms. Suleiman went into labor at 31 weeks, the babies weighed between 1 pound 8 ounces and 3 pounds 4 ounces. 6 boys, 2 girls. Never before had so many been born at once and survived, a medical marvel overshadowed by its treatment in the supermarket glossies. Ms. Suleiman played the callous brood mare, a cartoon character called the Octomom. She spent hundreds of thousands on plastic surgery to resemble her idol, Angelina Jolie. The magazines accused a single mom on food stamps, a crazy who'd do anything to build a family. In other words, a character perfect for a so-called reality era when circus sideshows became the main act. God, so it goes on. She cashed in. When the money ran out, she turned desperate. A short-lived pornographic film career, stripping, boxing, a suit by Gloria Allred followed accusations of child endangerment and exploitation, and she went on Oprah and Dr. Phil to shore up her side. Now the kids are 9 years old and amazingly healthy, and so it's a pretty feel-good story in your New York Times. Griffin has given me the 10 worst movies and 10 best movies of 2018, according to Tribune film critic Michael Phillips. I know, Griffin, that you see a lot of films. In fact, on Twitter, you were doing this year, you're trying to watch one film a week and then review it.
Did you not
follow through on that?
No, the original plan was one a day.
Oh my gosh, you were going to do 365?
Well, it didn't work out that way, but I got definitely more than one a week. So
okay.
I like that we started there. Let's pretend that was, and I overachieved.
Yes, oh, you did really well then. How many,
failing miserably.
Instead of 52, how many did you end up getting for
the year? I think 180, 190. So it's more like every other day.
And was this wasn't going to the theater seeing new movies?
No. Just anything. It was honestly like, I was just like, oh, a personal goal for me. Maybe I'll mention it to a couple people. And then it was all of a sudden the pressure of talking about it here.
Didn't work out.
And I was like, oh, I know I'm going to disappoint everyone. And that's what happened. But yeah, no, I saw a lot of stuff, yeah.
Okay, so you're watching new films, old films, classics, all sorts of stuff. Out of the 100-some that you've watched this year, and were these all ones you hadn't seen before? Did you revisit some?
No, that was the point.
Yeah. What was the best thing you saw, whether it was new or old?
Oh, man. I guess the ones that I've thought about a lot actually is one that's set at Christmas, not a typical Christmas movie, but I know people talk about it a little bit this time of year, called The Shop Around the Corner, the 1940 Jimmy Stewart movie.
And that's what You've Got Mail is based on.
Exactly,
correct?
Yes, okay. Exactly. That one was probably the most fun I had watching anything. Another that's directed by Ernst Lubitsch, and another movie by him, another great comedy by him, is called To Be or Not to Be.
Okay.
It was in 1942, and it's about World War II. It's about Nazis in Europe. It's hysterical, believe it or not. Those were great discoveries.
Interesting.
And they're probably, you know, they're very famous to many people, but I hadn't seen them.
Sure. And are they readily available when you're looking for, or what are you subscribing to where you're finding your movies?
Well, actually, it was a subscription service called Filmstruck, which just, for old movies like that specifically, that just died, unfortunately. Mm. It was canceled by Warner. The Time Warner was the company that owned it. And it had, like, all the Criterion Collection and a lot of old Hollywood classics. And they just shut it down in late November. So that made a lot of people, including me, very sad. But Criterion is starting something very similar up next spring, which you can already subscribe to, called the Criterion Channel. So
okay.
That's where I was seeing a lot of stuff. Also, one that I just watched on there, it was like the last movie I watched on that. Amy's okay.
Amy, you okay?
Amy's struggling.
She does not like your reviews.
I'm done. I'm almost done, I swear. It was called The Night of the Hunter. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
1950, starring Robert Mitchum. It's one of the that's also probably like maybe the best thing I saw this year.
The Night of the Hunter.
I would really recommend that one.
Okay, excellent. And what about? Do you go see a lot of newer movies? Do you subscribe to MoviePass or anything like that?
No, that's not possible anymore.
Did MoviePass
quit
taking?
Recipes to MoviePass also. All these great...
That thing completely died?
I think so. It might still be alive.
I know that they kept changing things and aggravating
a lot of
people.
It's a real like ghost of itself if it's still alive. Like, it's not what it was for sure.
I was at the movies recently, and AMC is offering a service, like the AMC A1 Stubbs Club or whatever, and for $19.95 a month, you can see up to 3 movies a week. So that's 12 a month for $19.95. That's a good deal,
too. They're kind of picking up the mantle. Yeah, I was thinking of subscribing to that, but I haven't yet. No, but I see some stuff in theaters. Now's the time when all these lists come out where you start to feel like, oh, man, did I see anything? But I'm feeling pretty good about... I've seen, I think, 9 of 10 on Michael Phillips' best list, and then 1 of 10 on his worst. So,
well,
that's good.
His worst list of the year, number 10 was Red Sparrow. That was a Jennifer Lawrence movie. 9 was Death Wish, the reboot of the old, what was the name of the...
Charles Bronson. They shot that in Chicago.
Did they really?
Yes.
Sleaziest reboot of the year, says Michael Phillips. Rampage, which was a Joel Cohen movie.
Also in Chicago.
The 1517 to Paris, that's, of course, the true story of the guys that on the train that stopped a guy from stabbing people.
A terrorist plot,
yeah.
I think. Yeah, that was a Clint Eastwood movie. Yeah.
And he says that did not work out. Aquaman, which is just hasn't even opened up here yet, but Michael Phillips saw it and gave it 6th worst of the year. Avengers Infinity War, which...
That's the one that I think will make a lot of people mad more than any of these.
Because that was...
To see that on a worst
list.
Not
only did it make a lot of money, but people that like those movies really loved it, right?
I was generally liked, yes. I have a hard time with the Marvel movies, to be honest. Most Marvel movies. So I didn't I didn't love it either. I got a sick thrill of seeing on his worst list, I have to say.
Welcome to Marwin, the new Steve Carell movie directed by Robert Zemeckis that's about to open up that I've seen a lot of previews for,
yeah.
And I'm very curious about, so I'm sad to see that it's
that was tough
list.
Tough to see it on the worst list too, and it'll be especially tough for John Williams, the host of this show. Usually he's very excited about that movie.
Oh really?
He's
and
like,
he might love it. I mean, they're all opinions, right?
It absolutely, yeah. It's absolutely true, but he's really jacked up about that. He will be sad to see that Michael said that.
Number three, Death of a Nation. I've never even heard of that film. Dinesh D'Souza's Trump infomercial equates the president's accomplishments with those of Abraham Lincoln's.
He made a lot of those documentaries during the Obama years about how horrible
Barack Obama was.
I don't know.
Number two, Life Itself from the creators of This Is Us. Number one, The Happy Time Murders, which was the crazy Muppet type movie.
Yeah, like the adult Muppet comedy.
Yeah.
Which, with Melissa McCarthy.
With the premise, that sounds... I don't. Why did people rag on that so much?
I don't know. I didn't see it, but a movie is more than a premise. So it was just in the execution, I guess. But it
your
made
quote of the day from the John Williams Show. Everybody, take this with you. Grant Filipich said, "A movie is more than just a premise."
And it made for a tough summer for Melissa McCarthy, but she's having a great winter with Can You Ever Forgive Me?
And that is the one where I've seen the trailers for this, where she is forging letters from authors and then selling them.
Yes, very good.
Which seems like a very tough premise for a really great, I don't know, it just
it's
seems
small,
like a weird
it's
premise.
It's small stakes.
Yes.
Because it's like, it's a crime technically, but who's really that mad about it? You wonder who the victim of this crime, but it's very interesting. It's a really good movie. And
you saw it?
I loved it. It's number three on Michael Phillips' best list.
What? Give me Michael Phillips' top 10 real quick.
The number one was this movie called The Rider, about a guy who rode in rodeos, mm-hmm. and then hurt himself and with a brain injury, and is recovering from that and wants to get back on the horse but knows that he shouldn't.
Mm.
It's just about his struggle with
that.
Very beautiful. Number two was Roma, which just opened up. It's on Netflix, too. You can watch it now on Netflix starting yesterday, I think.
Is this the Alfonso Cuarón movie?
That's right.
Okay.
And people are going crazy for that. Can You Ever Forgive Me? It was number three. The Favorite, starring Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, set in, like, Victorian England.
Yes. Okay, I've
That's
seen ads for this.
That's number four. Minding the Gap was set in Rockford, Illinois. The documentary set in Rockford, Illinois is number five, about three kids that... grow up skateboarding.
Okay.
Did you hear anything? It opened on Hulu, so I think it went under the radar for a lot of people. You can watch it on Hulu.
Okay.
They bought it and opened it up. Widows, number six.
Oh, this was the revenge. Who's in this?
The
movie?
Heist movie with oh boy. Well, Colin Farrell. There's like a million people in it. Now I'm blanking too. Viola Davis is the lead. Yeah. Liam Neeson. First Reformed is number seven with Ethan Hawke. He plays a priest who starts to become disaffected and look contemptuously on his church.
Okay.
And he's scared about climate change.
Interesting.
Relatable.
Okay.
Number eight was Sorry to Bother You. Zama, a movie called Zama is number nine. That's the only one that I haven't seen on here yet. I'm excited to. And then number 10 was Black Panther. So he's got some hate for the Marvel Universe in his worst and some love for it in his best.
What's interesting, and I think what's tough for the general public with movie critics, is that they see all these fabulous movies, they see all these terrible movies, they have, a harsher judgment than most of us have because they have to see everything. And then so a lot of the stuff that Michael really liked, and while you found it, a lot of those are kind of tough to find right now, right? The one you said is just on Hulu.
Yeah.
You know, Roma is going to be in very few theaters. All the really great movies tend to be smaller movies that don't appeal.
I guess it depends on what you mean by tough to find. Like, in theaters, yes, a lot of beloved movies by critics don't open wide.
Right.
But if you wait, then eventually they will be streaming somewhere.
Sure.
And most people have some access to a lot of different streaming platforms. It might mean a subscription that you have to pay or a rental. But in some ways, it's easier to find things than ever, too.
That's true. There's more availability than ever, as long as you're willing to pay the subscription fees to somewhere. All right, we got to take a quick break. Amy Guth coming up with the business lunch next, 720 WGN. Matt Bubile here with you on 720 WGN. A texter from 847 says, free DVDs at the library. And that's a way to do it as well.
That's totally true. That's something that gets overlooked way too much in conversations like this. And they have there's a streaming service that you can sign up through the library, too, called Canopy,
mm-hmm.
with a K. which has a lot of the titles, like older titles that I was saying you could only find on Filmstruck. It's not true. You can find them on Canopy as well.
And then you can download them. You just watch, or you just stream them through your laptop or your.
I actually haven't signed up for it yet, but I've heard a lot of people recommending it. So.
Very interesting. Yeah. Okay. 312-981-7200. I'm Matt Bubala. I'll actually be back tomorrow morning filling in for Steve Dale with Steve Dale's Pet World at 6:30 in the morning. We're going to have Dr. Natalie Marks from Blum Animal Hospital in to talk about your pets, especially as we head into this holiday season. And then I'll be back filling in for John a couple times over the Christmas break, and I'll be back at my usual show, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Friday into Saturday mornings here on 720 WGN. We'll find out what's coming up on the Business Lunch next with Amy Guth. You steal that.
I'm breaking.
She's destroying things. Wow.
I'm trying to get a microphone cover and I'm like knocking things over.
You could have just switched chairs.
Can I get a mulligan on this day? Falling apart here. Oh my God. I mean, just kidding to management. No one broke anything.
No, it's all fine. Little duct tape fix everything around here. It's only what, a couple mil they spent on the
way.
New, yeah. Here in the Allstate Skyline Studios. It's covered, right?
Yeah,
it's fine. Fix it.
I'm sure it's fine.
What's
I've had like a spree of weird luck lately, like
really?
In the, you know, like step on a rake, get hit in the face, fall off a thing, like just weird stuff. The last like 3 or 4 days, I just feel like an anvil's coming.
Well, maybe you're getting it all out of the way.
Yeah, so maybe. That 2019 can be so awesome. I'm getting like the last of the 2018 weirdness out of my system because it's been a weird year.
Has it been a weird year?
Yeah, it's been a weird year.
Oh.
Yeah. So, not good, not bad, just, you know, weird. But ending fabulously. So,
true.
You know. So there's that.
Always got to think positive about
the
new year.
That's right. I love the new year, personally. I think it's like the clean slate kind of holiday. I love it.
See, I agree with you, but
I feel like we've had this conversation on the air before.
We probably have, because I always use it badly. Like, I just started a diet this week, and I'm always like, I'm going to get organized. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then a month later,
February 1st, you're like, no.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I just run out of steam, but I feel like at the end of the year, I always put things off because, well, I'm going to start that in the new year.
Oh, I see.
In the new year. And then you like kind of push things away.
The thing I don't love about the new year is like the yoga classes and the gym is all there. It's
insane.
Packed. You're like, can you guys drop off already? Because I just like my spot back.
That'd be me. I'll be there on the yoga mat next year. I'm going to try this out this year. And you're like, oh, God, get out of here. You're slowing us all down.
Right. Well, anyway, we are here for some business and some lunch. Actually, no, there's never
no
lunch involved. It's always just business.
Isn't it?
I should have a better contract. Someone call my agent too. There should be lunch involved.
I don't know if I'd push that at the end of the year.
Absolutely not. Well, we are going to be talking about Apple's proposed new campuses in Austin and Seattle.
$1 billion in Austin.
Yeah. So that's. I mean, it's kind of fascinating. That's a conversation we've been having about Amazon HQ and all that. And so now we're having this conversation with Apple. We're also going to be talking about Mattel. They've got big new plans for Barbie. We've talked about some of their business moves on the program before with great interest. So we're going to do that. And, we are going to be talking with a financial professional about the markets. And to finish things off, we're going to be checking in with a reporter at Bloomberg that we've talked to before following a series about predatory lending practices. Mm. It's a really, really interesting series. There, so we're going to find the latest because there's some movement there.
That sounds like a very full hour. Have a great show.
Thanks so much.